Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to speak on this interesting day. This is joint work with David Caldwell. And I've given variants of this talk on many occasions, and David's given variants of this talk on many occasions as well, so I apologize if you've heard it before, but I think it fits quite well with the theme of today's symposium, mini symposium. Okay, so what I want to talk about is some newish examples of Poincaré-Einstein metrics. So Robin set the scene very nicely for us in the first talk. I hope I don't need to say too much more about the setting. We've seen the definition now. So the results that I want to talk about, they come from combining two separate things. So there are two important ingredients. The first is a construction of Einstein metrics, in fact, self-dual Einstein metrics. So there's a construction due to David Caldwell and Henrik Pedersen a few years ago. So they gave a local classification of toric self-dual Einstein metrics of non-zero scalar curvature. So as in Robin's talk, if there's any confusion about this, here self-dual means self-dual Weyl tensor. Or if you like, these are Einstein metrics that are conformally half flat.
And what does toric refer to?
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So toric in relativist language means there are two commuting Killing vectors. Of course the dimension is 4 here. And toric at least locally would mean there exist two commuting Killing vectors. But to get global examples, and these will generate a smooth action of a two torus on the manifolds we're interested in. So that's one thing that we use. The other is, for want of a better phrase, toric topology. So by this I mean there's a sort of combinatorial description of smooth four manifolds, smooth simply connected say compact four manifolds, M admitting smooth, everything is smooth action of the two torus T2 S1 plus S1 And I mean, this action is meant to be non-trivial. I mean, it's the generic orbit is meant to be a copy of the two torus itself. So these are, we combine these, and the claim is we get interesting examples of Poincaré-Einstein metrics. In fact, self-dual Poincaré-Einstein metrics. Okay, so yes, these combine in a very nice way to give our examples. Okay, so I could start with either one, and I'll start with ingredient one. So the remarkable thing about this, I think there are two remarkable things about it. One is that Coldman and Pedersen reduced this problem down to linear partial differential equations. So the a metric of this kind is determined by a linear, by an eigenfunction of Laplacian on the hyperbolic plane. And the other is that this is actually local classification. This is not a mere ansatz. This actually gives you everything, at least locally. So one can then prove. I mean, there's some other things we did together which are less relevant today, but given a toric self-dual Einstein metric, orbifold metric, say, you know that it's of this form, and that gives you further information about it. But I don't want to dwell on that now. Okay, so let me describe this as if it were an ansatz, because actually that's how it's going to be used today. So let's let U be an open subset of the hyperbolic plane. And I shall always think of this in the half-space model. So H2 has coordinates x, which is positive, and y, which is just real. So the metric is the x squared plus dy squared over x squared. And we've got some open subset of it. So this Coldbank-Pedersen instruction says the following thing. If f satisfies so this is the negative operator, just for explicitness, contrary to Robin's conventions. So if it satisfies this, then there's basically a black box which converts this solution, this linear equation, into a self-dual Einstein metric. So I'll write down give you some feeling for what this looks like. So there's some factor, and then there's the base metric. Maybe I'll write it out explicitly. And then there's the metric on the torus part. So I'll write that like this. Now I'll try to explain what all the bits are. So then that metric, which I can write down, is self-dual Einstein where to find on, well, it's strictly speaking on some open subset, or could be on some open subset of U cross the two torus. The point being that clearly if F vanishes, then you've got problems, and if this quantity I've called debt vanishes, you've also got problems. But I mean, where it all makes sense, it's self-dual Einstein on this space U cross T2. (Clears throat) Okay, well, I need to say some more. And the myths. Give me that. Okay, so there's a lot that I haven't defined in there. So I'll just run through roughly what these things are. So this quantity debt the sign is important. Okay, so that's this quantity. It doesn't look much like the term, but actually it is. So that's this quantity which is made out of the first derivatives of f. So the important thing about this is that, assume I've got the sign right, so debt has the opposite sign to scalar curvature of gf. So if debt is positive, then the scalar curvature is negative, and otherwise, conversely. And so about the notation, so v1 and v2 are certain maps from u to r2 made out of f and its first derivatives. They're completely explicit things. And dz is a, and dz, I've just lumped the, that's a vector-valued one form, and I'm thinking of z1 and z2 as coordinates on the two torus. And actually, this diamond bracket is really the symplectic pairing on R2. So when I write V1, V2, I actually mean the determinant of the matrix whose columns are V1 and V2. Okay, so hopefully at least to... So at least to first approximation, I think I've defined everything. So the main point is that if I have a solution, this, if I have an eigenfunction, then I can write down this metric, and I know it's self-dual Einstein away from the obvious singularities. So I should say this quantity is also this. So it is a determinant. So the only possible singularities actually come when V1 and V2 get linearly dependent. Clearly, you're going to have a problem. I mean, that sort of angular part is degenerating more. But there's this factor of debt as well, so all sorts of stuff can happen. OK? Yeah, so, and the commuting killing vectors. It's clear that nothing, you don't see a z anywhere in the formula, so you have commuting killing vectors. D value Z1, D value Z2. Right? Okay. All right. Let me say a little bit about the singularities that can happen. That you have to take care of when trying to use this ansatz. So,
before you talk about singularities, how does this inner product of V1 and V2 behave as you go to the boundary? I mean, is this completely compact or something?
So I'm just taking a little open subset of the hyperbolic plane, looking at that cross T2 and writing down this metric, and I mean. So certainly if U goes out to the boundary, then you need to take care of how the quantities behave. I mean, a lot of my talk is going to be talking about that, in fact. Okay. But I mean, at the moment, this is just a local construction of some locally defined self-dual Einstein. I mean, it makes sense where it makes sense at the moment. And we'll take care of x going to 0. And Because this x is the boundary defining function of H2, which is not going to be the boundary defining function of the boundary of the four manifold. So in that, so okay.
Can I just ask a question about your second item? You say that debt has opposite sign to scalar curvature.
Yeah.
So what happens if it vanishes?
Well, then the whole, I mean, if
it's
completely the whole thing,
a void case.
It's a void case, yes. So actually, one should be able to get something like the given Sorkin ansatz out of this in some limit, I would imagine. But I mean, I was careful to say, at least I remember at the last minute to say, that this is a construction of self-Einstein metrics of non-zero scalar curvature.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Right. So
But it also helps.
The zero scalar curvature case is taken care by you many years ago.
In the positive scalar curvature case, does it?
In the positive scalar curvature case, it works.
Is it a global construction then, or can you make it?
You can make it global, yes. Of course, there aren't too many examples. But so one of our papers is about, I mean, there aren't too many smooth examples, but there are orbifold examples, and we have a paper sort of talking about some circumstances under which certain orbifolds anyway admit such metrics.
But no smooth compact examples. No.
Well, I mean, there's this old theorem of Nigel's, right, which it's just... Isn't it just the four sphere and CP2?
Yeah, but can you capture them?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's... Any other questions at this point? Okay, I wanted to... So, Robin led me to the next point. So, let's suppose... I'll just draw a picture. So discussing the singularity, suppose V is a... No. Possibly a subset of this capital U. And suppose that we've managed to make the determinant not vanish on V. So, I mean, you have an F, and it makes sense to insist that the determinant is never zero there. I mean, it may happen. But F might still have a zero there. In fact, well, okay, so we learn two things immediately. So, I mean, if F has a zero and the determinant is non-zero everywhere, then it must be positive. Of course, I'm thinking of E being connected as well. Okay, so if F has any zeros and we know the determinant is non-zero, then the determinant must actually be positive. And then that tells you that the gradient of F is non-zero, and so you must, the zero set is actually a smooth submanifold. So, actually it has to be a smooth curve, or smooth piece of a curve inside V. Of course, it could have bits. I mean, it could have, a priori, it could have bits like this. So, sorry, there's V. I'm going to call this zero set Z, capital Z. Okay, so it must be like this. And then this metric is automatically, assuming we're in the interior of hyperbolic space again, so that X is not zero, then this formula automatically defines something that is, as you might call it, locally Poincaré-Einstein, because as you go towards this zero set, you see a nice big double pole of a defining function out the front of the metric. So since F squared GF extends smoothly through Z, see that GF is sort of locally Poincaré-Einstein.
What about the singularity when x equals
0? Well, I'm staying away from there. So let's just take x to be positive as well at the moment. So we're well in the interior of the hyperbolic plane at the moment. All right. So this capital F is Robin's X, right? It's the bound, or rather the pullback to the torus is Robin's boundary defining function.
Does it make a difference which side you're on?
No, I mean, so if you have, yeah, I mean, in this case, I mean, it's clear that, I mean, if you have this determinant being non-zero, then the conformal structure is good on the whole of V, because you can just get rid of F squared.
Plus or minus F is my X.
Yeah, plus or minus F is your X. So. Correct. Okay. So, I mean, the picture is that if you've managed to take care of the determinant, then you have these sort of two pieces, V plus and V minus, and near any zero, well, placing F by mod F is if necessary, you get, you have a smooth conformal structure, and you, I mean, there's a conformal factor that makes it Poincaré unsigned from either side of the local. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to very simple.
You started by mentioning a classification.
Yes.
And now you've given us. So how far is this from the whole?
Well, the statement is that if you give me a self-dual Einstein metric with two commuting Killing vectors, then at least locally there's a capital F, which assume that F is yes. Okay, so to move towards global examples, it's not clear this is the only thing you could do, but what you can do is the following. So we'll assume F is defined on all of the hyperbolic plane. And then, much as in, exactly as in Robin's talk, it's a fact that if f of xy is bounded by a power of x, possibly negative, then you can prove that there's a Dirichlet boundary value type thing, but it comes with a power. So f doesn't have a good limit, but if you multiply by root x and then I call that little f, has a distributional limit. As x goes to zero. Now, of course, I've broken. I mean, this statement obscures the sort of naturality of everything. So, I mean, I chose up a half space coordinates, which meant I broke the natural symmetry of the isometries. I don't have the isometries of the hyperbolic plane anymore. But this is an invariant equation, and in fact, this makes good sense also as x goes to infinity if you interpret it appropriately. So the boundary value has to be interpreted as a section of some density bundle. Mm-hmm. You don't believe it? Okay. So be that as it may, I'm just going to write them in that sort of motivation. What I'm going to use is a Poisson-like formula to reconstruct little f and hence big f from this distribution boundary value. And actually the distributions I'm going to be using are not very scary. They're all actually continuous, they're not differentiable functions.
Are there no bounded solutions then? Or?
Sorry?
No bounded solutions?
No bounded solutions. So we have a Poisson-type formula. Which is the following, that let me call this distribution limit something, so I'll use, as I said, my distributions are actually functions, so let me call it, so let me use classical notations for distributions, let's call it U of Y. So if I write down this formula, sorry, and I have to assume that U is not too big at infinity, having written it this way, then the claim is that F equals x to the minus a half F solves our equation with quotes boundary value U, by which I mean, in the sense, the boundary value of little f is this U. This is an entirely classical formula which you can find in, it's certainly in chapter one of Helgeson's second book,
I think. Before you raise, before you raise this metric, is it clear that you have a global solution in a geometric sense, this subset of the hyperbolic space plane where f is defined should be the whole hyperbolic plane? That's one question.
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Suppose we want a...
it's not clear. I think it's the answer. It's not clear. And in fact,
Well,
if you want compact examples without boundary, then it does. You can prove that it does have to be the whole of hyperbolic plane, if it's simply connected.
But that would be the opposite sign.
That would be the opposite sign. Yeah, but I mean, well, the sign has not been addressed yet. But what I'm going to do is construct Poincaré-Einstein metrics by taking the F to be global. But then there is going to be a zero set somewhere, and that's going to give me the conformal boundary of the manifold. Now you could conceive of the F being defined in a smaller set and still get complete metrics out of this construction. But the problem in doing that is that it's difficult to control. I mean, the last remnant of the nonlinearity is this debt quantity, which you have to keep away from zero. And we only know how to do that if we have a global function f, as I'll now tell you.
So this is my next question. Is it clear that the determinant equals zero is actually a singular set, or it could be just another infinity or something like that?
It's a genuine singularity. So the scalar curvature tends to change sign as you go through that. So it's a simple zero.
Are there global solutions on the hyperbolic plane which are not bounded by powers of x?
Yes, I think so. If you do something horrible like make the boundary value hyperfunctional rather than distributional, then you can get them growing fast in powers of x.
So this is quite a nice subset of all possible f.
The best. Yeah. So this is extremely classical stuff, which you can read about in... chapter one of Helgeson's second book, I guess, the one on called groups and does this sort of nonlinear theory for hyperbolic plane, the sphere and R2, which is just only Fourier theory, I suppose. Okay, so let me tell you how we can take care of the plot of this debt quantity if we have these global functions. So this tells you that everything is determined by this boundary value, and here's a proposition which allows us to take care of this nonlinear quantity in this case. So I mean, there are a lot of hypotheses here. So we'll assume that U is continuous. I mean, it's partly designed for an application which I haven't explained to you why this is, why all these assumptions are natural, but they are. So we suppose U is continuous. So suppose, first of all, U is continuous. U of Y tends to plus or minus 1 as Y goes to plus or minus infinity. So it's infinity. Right, so this is a little bit ugly. So let's say that U primed, the derivative, has support in some interval AB, some bounded interval AB, and is greater than 0 in AB. So the picture to be forming is that it's, let me give you the last condition. So that's the third. The most important is that UU double primed is negative every point, non-positive. So we've got a function. What's a typical U look like? It comes in from plus infinity being plus 1, and it comes in from minus infinity being minus 1. And then it has to be where U is positive, so we're going to have a 0 somewhere. So it's only allowed to increase, and it's only allowed to change in a of this interval AB, where it has to be strictly increasing. And it's meant to be concave, where it's positive, and convex, where it's negative, which is kind of weird, but that's... So I'll draw it piecewise linear, because that's the natural condition. So it's meant to do something like that. Okay, so it's concave to the right of its zero and convex to the left of its zero. So we assume that we have such, I mean, it's clear that such U's exist. And then the claim is, then, Z is positive in H2. Okay. So that by this I mean that you make the function out using the, by plugging into the Poisson formula, and then you make the determinant out of that function. So this gives you a way of writing down solutions where the determinant is good over the whole of the hyperbolic plane. And you can say stuff about what happens as x goes to 0 as well, but in the interest of brevity, I won't. But it does what it has to do. Okay, so this allows us to take care of the problem that the determinant might change sign a priori. Okay, so then, I'm now going to tell you a family of sort of global but not necessarily complete metrics. So you take one of these U's, you take the hyperbolic plane cross the two torus, so take U on the real line, satisfying the conditions of the proposition, and start construct F from the Poisson formula. And let's consider G sub F. So the only remaining singularities, given that we took care of this determinant, are where F is 0. So this is good. Away from F equals 0. When I write this, obviously, I mean the pullback to the product with the torus, strictly speaking. So it's good away from the 0 set of F. And we've already seen that this is a submanifold. So, or it's a smooth curve in the hyperbolic plane, and its lift is a smooth submanifold of this product. But in fact, it has to be a simple arc. And that's basically the maximum principle, given these assumptions. So if I draw I said I'd stick to half-space coordinates, but now I'm going to revert to not half-space coordinates. And the point is that, so here's the hyperbolic plane again. We've got this F defined in it. We know that F, actually, it's not obvious from this picture, but actually it should vanish at infinity as well. I mean, the boundary value has a zero at C, right? So the boundary value U is greater than or equal to zero over here, and less than or equal to zero over here, roughly speaking. And so here's the zero set. And so by the maximum principle, you have, so I mean, F is zero here, sort of positive here, and so it has to be positive on each side. I mean, it has to be positive on this side and negative on the other. That's the only possibility, given the boundary values being like that. Okay. Because it vanishes on its where it's zero. Okay. So you don't know where the zero set is, but you can apply the maximum principle on the two pieces. So F, if the boundary value is this form, decomposes the hyperbolic plane into these two pieces, and as here's Z, the zero set. And as before, as you go into this zero set, you're going to get conformally compact behavior. Mm-hmm. So you get, that's the picture.
Question? So your picture suggests that the conformal boundary has actually corners. Is it what's happening?
No, and yeah, it suggests that, but it can be made okay. Yeah, I mean, you have to.
The boundary is some sort of circle bundle over a torus or torus bundle over a circle?
Yeah, so the boundary will be, we don't know anything yet about what happens at the boundary of the hyperbolic plane. But, the boundary at the moment is just an open interval cross, topologically it's just an open interval cross the two torus. Because, I mean, there's a two torus sitting above every point.
Yeah.
So it's just a...
You're going to add some other arc.
Yes, indeed. So. Okay, so to explain what to add to make complete examples, I have to go and say a bit about this toric topology business. So just as a warm-up, let's remind ourselves that if you have the ordinary two-sphere, then you can think of it as a circle bundle with singularities. Okay, so you have just I haven't drawn it as a height function, but just this vertical projection. So you get F2 as an S1 bundle over the interval. Well, what's really true is that S2, take away two points, P and Q, is a circle bundle over an open interval, right? So you remove the two singularities of the two special orbits of the circle action, which is just rotation, and there is, what's left over is just a cylinder. Okay. So if I write down the spherical metric, so this is for, I mean, this is. Okay, if I write down the spherical metric in these coordinates, then I can actually let R go to zero and to pi, and what I have is a degenerate metric on the cylinder, okay, on the compactified cylinder. So extends as a degenerate metric on sort of the closed interval, pi, across the circle. And you can see upstairs on this cylinder whether the singularities are right or not to make it extend smoothly to the sphere. It needs to be like R squared at each end. So we're going to do the same thing in four dimensions, only it's clearly more complicated. So, but the idea is very similar. So the claim is that you can remove, so let's do this. So, I mean, here I'm following a paper by Orlik and Raymond, who studied smooth actions of the two torus on four manifolds. So this is C infinity actions of T2 on M4. And the M is meant to be simply connected and orientable form. So again, I'm actually going to be, I don't need the classification, I'm just going to use it as a way of constructing interesting four manifolds. So the basic picture is that is the following, that there's some subset S, the union of the special orbits, such that if you remove it, you get a polygon across the two torus. Or, I mean, the polygon is, I mean, at the moment we're just doing topologies. This polygon is really just a topological disk. Okay, so you take out this stuff, you take out the where the action is not free, and what is left over is something like this. So this is an open polygon, which is hard to tell from a disk, of course. And T2 is T2. Okay, so you remove this stuff, the nuts and the bolts being removed, and you're left over with this. So if you think about it a little bit more carefully, what's different in now is that, I mean, if you think about what's happening in that example, then obviously as you go to the two poles of this, I mean, as you go to the special orbits here, the circles are shrinking, right? In the torus, you have a choice of circles, and any one of those could shrink. Okay. That's, so you need some notation to take care of that. So, in fact, so why don't I do the obvious example where M is not compact, but, let's consider the T2 action on R4. Viewed as R2 plus R2. Okay, so you have a circle rotating this factor and a circle rotating that factor. Okay, so you can see what the action is by introducing, I mean, you can see exactly what's going on by introducing polar coordinates. So if we use, I'll identify the R2s with C, so we have an R1 e to the I theta 1, R2 e to the I theta 2. The action of the torus is just addition to the thetas, so the quotient is clearly a quadrant. Okay. So it's just the R1 and R2 axes. You have those axes. And okay, but different circles are being shrunk as you go down to either of these axes. Okay, so as you go down to here, the isotropy group, if I get this right, so R2 is zero, so if you move in, if you add to theta 2, you don't see anything. So the isotropy group is generated by d by d theta 2, I think. And here, isotropy generated by d by d theta 1. Okay, so you have different circles shrinking as you go down to these two these two faces. Okay. Okay. So the general case is sort of like that, but obviously more complicated. So in general, get a labeled polygon so something like this, any finite number of sides, then you label it by the circle subgroup that is the isotropy group as you approach that edge. Okay, so this label means that the isotropy group as you go out to this edge is generated by M1 d by dz1 plus N1 d by dz2. And similarly as you go around. Okay? So that's what you have. Now, conversely, if you have a labeled polygon like this, then you can reconstruct, some sort of four manifold, except it will be an orbifold unless these m's and n's satisfy some conditions. So, that's really what's important for us, that we can start with such data and get an interesting four manifold. So, conversely, if you have a labeled polygon like this, and these pairs are co-prime, and mj, nj plus 1, minus nj plus 1, nj plus 1 minus 1, for all j, and this should be read, of course, mod the number of sides you have, and construct a smooth four manifold. Whose quotient? A smooth toric four manifold whose T2 quotient is this labeled polygon. Is the given. And it's very easy to deal with orbifolds, actually. Just you can get an orbifold with isolated singularities just by relaxing this condition, this determinant condition. If this was k instead, then you'd have a zk quotient singularity, assuming you still have coprimeness. Okay. So, one thing that took me a long time to get used to thinking about these pictures is that, that the boundary of this picture is somehow the core of the four manifold you're constructing, right? I mean, somehow, because this is where the topology lives in some sense. So, maybe I should just make that point. So, if you take... So I haven't said what the quotient map is. So let pi from m to m mod t2 be the quotient map. Okay. So pi inverse of a closed edge is a copy of the two sphere, and in fact the homology of the manifold is generated by these spheres that you get by taking the premium. I mean, it looks exactly like the picture that I've erased. If you think about it, you've contracted one circle over this edge, so you have a circle bundle, but then you're contracting the other circle as well at the corners. So so pi inverse of a closed edge is a two sphere, and these two spheres generate the homology.
So S2 times S2 is just a square in this language.
S2 times S2 would be a square, yes. And CP2 is a triangle with some suitable simple labeling and so forth. Okay, so have to pull things together now. So I'm going to So to tie these things together, I mean, what's going to happen is that this topological polygon is going to get identified with the hyperbolic plane in some more or less natural way. And so I'm going to sort of choose a corner at random and put it at infinity, because that's how I was drawing my hyperbolic plane before. And if I do that, I then get... So for some reason, we started labeling from the right, and we never changed it. However, we re-identify the polygon as the upper half space, but with the boundary now cut into pieces and with these labels. And in fact, if there's fishy many of them, you can always assume that the first one is 0 minus 1, the next one is 1, 0. You choose those to be a standard basis. And then you can't, I mean, that's used up the SL2Z freedom that you have when dealing with tori. And actually, this label over here should be 0, 1. There's a sort of sign change as you go through infinity. So it's meant, I mean, that's the last one. Okay, so I'm going to use this data to write down a boundary value for a... I should assume something about these. So I'm going to, before I do that, so assume the MJ are all positive apart from the ones which are zero, which is just two of them. In fact, I'm going to fix the sign of this determinant thing. I hope that's the right way around. That's all I have in my notes.
Earlier you said plus or minus one for all j. Do you mean you have to make the same choice for all j?
No. No, it's a manifold of, this is true always. What I wrote here is true. Plus or minus one is what you need there. You see, if you think, these MJ and J only determined up to sign. Mm-hmm. Okay, because you're just talking about the groups generated by certain vectors. So, strictly speaking, the labeling is not by co-prime pairs or by co-prime pairs up to sign. So this condition only, plus or minus one only makes sense. However, for the class of manifolds I'm going to construct, there is a choice with M0 like this and M1 like this, and then all the rest plus one. Which is enough of my examples. Okay, does that answer your question, or not?
Yeah, fine.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
You made an extra choice.
Right. I made.
It's not really a choice. You just fixed an ambiguity.
It's not clear that I can have both this and this. If you give me a random sequence of m's and n's which only satisfy this, it's not clear I can choose the signs so that I have simultaneously all the m's positive and this the term always plus one. But that's what I can do. Okay, so if I have this, if I have such a sequence, and you'll see in a minute why I need this. If I've got this right, this makes the m's. The m's then are a monotonic sequence, I hope. I better have a last one. Let's call it NK. It's probably going to screw me up later. So this is then a monotonic sequence, I think. We're going to consider the following affine functions. We're going to consider the following function, in fact. So I'm going to write down about a putative boundary value, and it's just the min. Of all the affine functions mjy minus nj. So it's some sort of envelope of all these affine functions. So the first one is just the constant 1, and then you'll have, this is what I drew before. But now it's better motivated. So you expect something like this. That's what this envelope thing is meant to look like. That's what, I mean, at least for, well, I mean, this is meant to be to the right of where it's, to the right of it's zero. So this is convex, I mean, this is concave, where it's positive. And the idea is to continue it arbitrarily. So this is really, I guess this is to the right of probably nk over nk. Okay, and we continue it arbitrarily to the left, but subject to this convexity and monotonicity condition that we had in the proposition. So the claim is that if you plug this, plug such u into the formulae, so first into the Poisson formula and then into the ansatz of the metric, you get, so then GF extends smoothly to the compactification. Suggested by the labeling that you've got. Given by the labeling. Okay, so by making it this affine linear structure is exactly what you need to make the metric degenerate in just the right way so that it extends the special orbits. Okay. So what have we got? So this is a slightly rushed statement. So the conclusion. So maybe I should say it this way. So we write down a U like this, which to the right is determined by these M's and N's, and to the left could be anything, more or less. So we write down U gives us F. We write down GF on H2 cross T2, or rather, not on there, but on D plus cross T2, where D plus is this, so D plus is a set where F is positive. So then the claim is that GF extends to a Poincaré-Einstein metric on a compactification of this on the compactification. D plus cross T2, suggested by the labeling. It's this theory of compactifying these toric manifolds, these torus bundles. That's what we get. So, I'm out of time, I think. So let me just make a couple of remarks. So the conformal boundary is a Lens space. Lens space. It's a three-dimensional, so it's just a quotient of the three sphere. I should say a little bit about where these sequences come from, although I'm out of time. So these sequences. So they're very familiar in algebraic geometry, actually, or indeed toric algebraic geometry. So they come by doing a modified continued fraction expansion of a rational number. So if you insist that all the e's are at least 2, then they're unique. So I'm assuming I have a rational number that's strictly between 0 and 1. I make this continued fraction expansion. And then the approximants, so nj over mj, is what you get if you only go as far as ej minus 1 in this expansion. Okay. So this gives you, for free, anytime you give me a rational number, I can write down this a sequence like this, and it has these properties that I need. And in fact, this space that we're getting is the algebraic geometer's resolution of singularities of this singularity with of order q, and p tells you how cyclic root is acting.
So p and q label the Lens space.
Yeah, exactly. So p and q are the standard labels of the Lens space. There's one other thing I said. One very important thing I should have said. And haven't, which is that in fact, and this is very intriguing to me, for a smooth metric, I drew this picture without proving anything. For a smooth metric, you actually need all EJ greater than or equal to 3, actually. So a priori, if you expand anything, then these are at least 2. But for this picture to be genuine, you need all the E's to be at least 3. And what happens if they're not is the following. When you construct this this U, what you can have is something like this, where you have 3 of these affine functions, and they pass through the same point. So you're actually not getting everything you thought you were. But actually, the ansatz still works to give you an orbifold metric with sort of all the curves with EJ being 2 sort of contracted. Anyway, I think I should stop there because everybody's probably wanting their lunch.
Questions?
You still have lots of freedom in choosing you, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So, you get...
Why was it affine?
Sorry?
Why was it affine?
In order to extend the special orbits, it has to be affine.
Definitely has to be.
But you could do what the hell you like with it over here, right? So in fact, we're getting infinite-dimensional families of these self-dual-Einstein metrics, all living on these spaces, because we have this freedom to vary this function. Because we don't care about the boundary. I mean, you don't care about what happens as you go down to the boundary over here, because that's not in the, you've thrown that away. That's the other side of the conformal boundary. And the conformal boundary is coming out of here. So that what the function does to the right of that is absolutely determined if you want it to extend to special orbits. But on the other side, you can do anything you like. So actually, let me just say, because I think this is, you know, this fits in with Robin's talk. If you do the simplest possible extension to the right, which is just to go down to -1 and then cut off, so just go down linearly or affine linearly, and then cut off, then actually you have an example here of a... So let me draw another picture. So you have an example of a conformal structure on this Lens space which extends smoothly to a self-dual Einstein manifold with some interesting two spheres in it on one side, and to a self-dual Einstein orbifold metric on the other side. So this is a conformal structure. I mean, it has some of the properties of the round conformal structure. It extends either a self-dual metric or an anti-self-dual metric, trivially. But this extends to a smooth self-dual manifold on one side. And, well, or if you like, it extends as a smooth self-dual metric on one space or as an orbifold anti-self-dual metric on another space.
Why can't you just make it on the left side be symmetric like the top one and get 2 different smooth spaces?
That just doesn't work.
Isn't everything symmetric relative?
No, not. So not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can consider the odd extension of this to the left. That's certainly a legitimate choice. What goes wrong? Something goes wrong. That's right. The NMs are not then integers. I mean, if you read the NMs from there, they're not integers anymore. Because this is not the origin. So there's the slopes are the M's are okay, but the N's are actually rational number. So you'd have to sort of change the torus to get it to extend. I mean, that, you know, that it has a different kind of singularity, but something you can do. So that, you know, this kind of example suggests that there's a, you know, that this should give motivation for studying the sort of positive negative frequency ideas away from their unmetric as well, because I mean, this, although this conformal structure is, I mean, that, so that's the other thing about this whole picture. The boundary conformal structure is the least explicit thing of the whole game, because to determine it, you need to find the zero set of F, which is some function, and then you need to restrict F squared times GF to it. So, except in the case where this is, I mean, I said you can make this odd, and then at least you know where the zero set is, but you still have a somewhat complicated conformal structure on this Lens space. And, you know, I have no idea even whether it's your Yamabe positive or anything like that.
For a Taub-Bolt metric, do you know what F looks like? Or?
Taub-Bolt, remind me what. Oh, well, no, but that's not self-dual, is it? In general?
But I think there are some U2 invariant self-dual examples.
Maybe it's not self-dual either.
Yeah, those,
But they're all standard.
So in the paper with, so in the paper by Pedersen and Calderbank, I think they discuss where the Pedersen family of U2 invariant metrics, how that appears in
this. By a single integer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple special. I mean, that's right. I mean, I think it's. I mean, you can write down F explicitly as a sum of three terms. I think three terms. I mean, it's some sort of explicit.
Yeah. So the isometry group is really dramatically different from the. I mean, they're generally maximally inhomogeneous, given your assumption. Are they on the bound?
Yeah. I mean, the torus is all you have, if that's what you mean. Yeah.
Other questions? X-ray.
Oh,
sorry.
Too late.
Too late, yes, that's right.
Are the associated Lorentzian metrics? So can you wish to reproduce
them? No, it'd be complex.
Sorry?
It'd be complex.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Thanks.